2003, where the, it was very much like this situation, actually, where the opposition tried to overthrow the government, in that case by shutting down the oil industry and having some of the business owners go on strike. This time they're trying to do it by just going out into the streets and trying to have some peaceful, but also at night, the violent protests, trying to provoke violence and delegitimize the government in that way, to say that this is a repressive dictatorship. And I don't think it's going to get very far, partly because it's not a dictatorship. I mean, the government just won an election, just a little over 2 months ago, by a very wide margin.
These were the local elections, is that right?
These were the nationwide municipal elections. And Maduro himself was elected president in April. So they don't have a lot of legitimacy for their protest. They have legitimate complaints, you know, and if they were in the streets saying, you know, they want to do something about the inflation rate or crime or the shortages of, you know, some consumer goods and food, you know, I think that would have more resonance, and they might even be able to accomplish something. But the leaders of the protest started out from the beginning saying they want the government to resign. They want the president to resign. And, you know, it's a right-wing movement. I mean, it's led by, that's the other reason they're not going to get anywhere. These leaders, you know, Leopoldo Lopez, who's in jail right now, and Maria Corina Machado, these are very right-wing people. You know, Christian Amanpour interviewed Maria Corina Machado on TV the other day, and I think she had no idea she was interviewing the kind of the Glenn Beck of Venezuela. There's so much confusion here. People see all these crowds in the street and they think it's like Occupy or something. But it's a really right-wing movement. Not all the students are right-wing, but they're following a right-wing leadership. There's no independent movement of students in the streets that says, oh, we're not for these guys, you know.
Yeah. How
they're
do...
all backing the right-wing leadership, at least anybody with a voice is. So that's what makes it a really right-wing movement. And Venezuela is not a right-wing country, you know. It's not like Poland or someplace where people, a lot of people have right-wing views. I mean, there's a cluster, of course. There's the middle classes, and, you know, that's who they've got. But it's a decided minority, and they're not going to impose their will on the rest of the country, I don't think.
The question is, though, I mean, they do have some supporters. A lot of the middle class people just hated Chavez. I mean, it's like the hatred of Obama by some of these groups. Their world is being destroyed by this Antichrist or whatever. This communist is what they, in Venezuela.
Yeah, it's very similar, actually, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And there's a racial dimension to it as
right.
well.
Right. Yeah, the U.S. sort of though meddles there. I mean, many of these, the right-wing movements would collapse if it weren't, in fact, for support from U.S. NGOs, allegedly, and in fact, the U.S. government through the, the National Endowment for Democracy, they call it.
Yes.
They're funding these groups.
Money,
yeah.
And support. I think the money's not that important because these are rich people. They have most of the wealth and income of the country still. But, and they have media, too, you know, despite what you might read. You know, the television, 90% of the television audience is watching at any moment private television, and it's not as overtly hostile as it used to be, but it's not for the government, and it's against the government. And so, you know, and the newspapers are more against the government, and they're getting more aggressive in the current situation because this is a regime change thing, just like the U.S. media has gotten more prejudiced in this current situation, although not across the board. But, you know, for instance, you don't see them, in the press here, you get only right-wing sources right now. You know, they're not going to ask any of these academics or anyone that they, you know, they occasionally would ask and really occasionally, in the past, for comment, they're only going to people, the larger media outlets are only going to people who are going to give the kind of U.S. Government line. So I think the U.S. government has a huge role. I tell you, hey, this is how it really works. If you look at the April elections, this is a good example, because that was a closer election than they've had before. Maduro won by 1.8 percentage points. But it was no doubt about the result, because they have a very secure election system there. You know, Jimmy Carter called it one of the best in the world. It's not like here where we have a close election and we really don't know who won. You know, there, and this wasn't that close, of course. You know, we've had plenty of presidential elections closer than this. But what they do is they take a random sample of 54% of the voting machines, and everybody gets a receipt from their vote. When they press the vote, they have to look at the screen, and there's a vote that comes out, and they put that in a ballot box. So you have two records of every vote. And so what they do is, in front of the witnesses and anybody in the neighborhood wants to come, they compare the paper ballot with the machine. So that gives you a very solid recount right there. And, you know, we actually did a statistical calculation, and we showed that the probability of getting the recount result that they got on the election day, if the election were actually stolen, was less than 1 in 25,000 trillion. So, in other words, that's, you know, the people saying they were stolen were just really had no case. And what happened was the U.S. government supported their position and didn't recognize the election results, which is something they haven't done for more than a decade. It was a very aggressive move. And so that really gave them support. They were in the streets. They actually killed, 9 or 10 people were killed, but it wasn't as big a thing in the press because they were all Chavistas, almost all Chavistas who were killed.
It was all the supporters of the government who were killed. I see. Well, that doesn't matter in the United States at all, that the right-wingers are killing people.
So that's where the U.S. really, you can see the enormous influence of the U.S. because the U.S. has such an influence on the media. The media throughout the hemisphere, it's worse in Latin America than it here in the English-language media. They just follow, you know, U.S. Foreign policy, and what happens is, was, you know, they had support, and then the South American governments got very angry, and they were, and the Brazilians even denounced the U.S. for interfering, and so Kerry had to back off, our Secretary of State, and as soon as they implicitly recognized the government of Venezuela and recognized the results of the election, that was the end of the opposition movement to delegitimize it.
This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Mark Weisbrot, who does a weekly column in The Guardian in London and writes on U.S. foreign policy, critical of it. We've been talking mostly about Venezuela and the destabilization and efforts in Venezuela. You were talking about the left movements in South America, that Venezuela was the first with Chavez, and that the U.S. has lost influence in Latin America. But it does retain this sort of economic capacity to strangle governments that it doesn't like. And it maintains these financial tentacles that, in fact, now are draining the entire world. It seems to me that the people of South America and many of the governments, and at least in voting, they want to somehow get out from under the yoke of the U.S. But the U.S. has so much financial power and power over the media and really tries to shape economies. How is that playing out? And what do you see as the possible challenges to this sort of the supremacy of this sort of international financial elite led by this U.S. State Department and Army?
Well, in Latin America and especially South America, the U.S. has really lost that power. They don't have any significant financial power anymore in most of the region because they lost the IMF. Nobody's going to the IMF anymore.
But Venezuela does borrow in world markets, doesn't it? In
yeah,
some
but
ways,
and can't influence that. I mean, they can only influence that through the media in the extent that they can make the situation look worse than it is, so they might have to pay a higher interest rate. But no, basically they don't have that power. They have that power in Ukraine because there, you know, Ukraine is in a situation where it needs foreign exchange and it's going to go to the IMF. And that is why Yanukovych, the president who was just ousted, he didn't really have any choices because he could have gone to Russia, of course, and that was his choice, and he wanted to do that, but the mostly right-wing movement was too, it's not as divided, it's not as clearly divided there as it is like in Venezuela, of course, but his opposition, in any case, was, you know, not allowing that. So he really, if he had gone to the EU, and you'll see this with whoever becomes president there, the EU and the U.S., which act together with the IMF, in this case, I mean, they're going to destroy that economy, most likely. It'll be like Greece. And so they do have this enormous power still in countries that have to borrow to meet their balance of payments, but that hasn't been the case in most of Latin America and almost all South America for the last 10 years or so.
That makes it possible. And, I mean, we should mention that one of the reasons the U.S. has trouble with its destabilization policies and regime changes is it's a lot easier when you own the army and influence the army. When you don't, when you have no power over the Venezuelan army and police who stay loyal, or in the Ukraine, actually, where the army was, but at least it wasn't under the power of, it didn't take its directions from the United States and the West. It makes it a whole lot harder. Mark, we only have less than a minute. Conclude about how we can support the challenges.
Well, I think it's very important for people. I mean, you know, there's a bill in Congress right now, for example. And since there's, you know, a widespread lack of knowledge of what's going on in Venezuela, it has support in both houses to actually have sanctions against Venezuela. And I think anybody who wants to in Congress can contact their senator or their member of Congress and tell them, you know, that this is crazy, that this is a right-wing movement to overthrow the government that they would never support in the United States. Some of them would, but those people you don't have to contact. And that they shouldn't be aiding and abetting this and trying to destabilize a democratic government.
And over the long run, of course, it's will require movements in the United States that have considerable power that will support the sort of the real strivings of the working classes around the world against the sort of parasitic elites. I took the last word from you, Mark Weisbrot, but we have to end. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure.
Right, so long.
The big muddy when the big fool set to push on. Not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
That was a clip from Pete Seeger's Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. You were listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. That was an anti-war song that he first performed in 1967, late 67, for the Smothers Brothers show, and CBS didn't like the political tone of it, so they censored it. And then after a lot of public outcry, he was allowed to perform it and actually have it broadcast for the masses and inaugurating finalizing 17 years of being blacklisted for his political music. Well, up next, Movie Mole's Fran Michel and Denise Morris are going to review Orgasm, Inc., The Science of Female Pleasure. This film is from 2009 and is available through the Multnomah County Library. I will turn it over to Denise, who is going to give y'all a synopsis.
You never go tonight.
In 2001, documentary filmmaker Liz Kanner was asked by American pharmaceutical company Vivus to help with trials of a new drug, Alysta, a topical cream designed to remedy sexual dysfunction in women. Kanner's job? Edit a series of erotic videos which would be shown to women participating in early clinical trials. Interested in the nature of female desire, she took the job. She also got permission from Vivus to make a film that would document the process. During her involvement with the Alysta trials, Kanner began to question the nature of what was being termed female sexual dysfunction. As a result of her broadening inquiry, Kanner spent the next 9 years filming what would become Orgasm Inc., released in 2009. A film Liz Kanner describes as a document of, quote, the medical industry's attempt to change our understanding of the meaning of health, illness, desire, and that ultimate moment, orgasm. This will be fun, Fran, because we'll get to use words like orgasm.
Yes, yeah. In a purely scientific sort of way.
Exactly.
Far more scientific than most of the people involved in this film.
Yes, indeed, that would be very true. So Kanner goes from being a trusted insider employed by Vivus to documentary filmmaker and interviewer, and she's in need of getting her subjects, of course, to talk about the deeper questions and uncertainties with regard to, quote, female sexual dysfunction and the hunt for the cure, and no doubt a potentially lucrative one along the lines of Viagra for men. This is something the film is credited with doing well.
Yeah. Kanner really gets a lot of mileage out of simply asking basic questions of the people at Vivus, like, well, what is female sexual dysfunction, and how do you know that someone has it, and how does this drug work, and how is it supposed to work, and how do you know if it's working? Basic questions that she asks, and that they are often unable to give good answers to, because clearly, as it turns out, and she talks to some other people not involved in the pharmaceutical industry, but involved in sex toy stores or education or feminist activism, or, right, she talks to people who give better answers to some of these questions, and a lot of the answers have to do with, these drugs will make money for pharmaceutical companies if they can invent a disease, invent an ailment, and invent a cure for it, or invent a disease for something they've got a cure for. They can make a lot of money. And the whole inspiration for this idea of female sexual dysfunction seems to come from the popularity and money-making bonanza that was Viagra.
Yeah, and something that's come up in some more recent articles is really revealing a kind of interesting quandary that is sometimes that you get what you wish for, and that is, you know, this idea that, you know, there's been an unequal attention to women's sexual dysfunction as there has been with Viagra. I think you mentioned how many different drugs there are available for men to help them with their sex.
Currently, the figure that's being bandied about these days as there's another push to get a different drug approved by the FDA. And so there's been a lot of publicity in the interests, I'm sure. I haven't followed this up, but I suspect much of it is backed by the company that's trying to get this FDA approval through, pointing out that there are 24 different drugs that men can take for male sexual dysfunction of various sorts. Although, in fact, there's really only 4 or 5. They're just come under different brand names, and so it comes out to 24. But there are none approved for women. And so is that fair? Of course, then there's the whole question of, is this really the sort of equality we want? More drugs?
Right. And as you were saying earlier, you know, there are a number of questions being posed to these doctors and scientists over the course of the film. One of them is to the founder of Vivus being asked, you know, how is it that female sexual dysfunction came to be seen as a disease? And his only answer really is, I don't know.
Yeah.
But apparently 43% of women have it.
And this is a figure that is still being bandied around in the current debate over the next drug that they're trying to push through, even though, and the film makes clear, that the way that they arrived at this statistic was a study that asked, in the last month, have you felt no desire for sex? Have you felt, and that there's this long list, and I'm astonished that there would be 57% of the population that wouldn't check one of these things, because I myself, although I consider myself sexually healthy, do not constantly want to be having sex incessantly all the time and having an orgasm incessantly. I mean, that would be a bit much. Yeah.
Well, you have a full-time job, and
sometimes you want to sleep and do other things. And there's a great moment when one of the people that Kanner talks to, who is not involved with the pharmaceutical company, is Leonore Taefer, who's part of a group called A New View Movement. They want to work against the medicalizing of female sexuality and sexuality in general. And one of the things that Taefer says is that there's this notion that you should be feeling desire as though it's something that's entirely a property of the individual and not something that happens in relationship. And she says, you know, you don't go around wondering whether you're feeling feelings of friendship. You know, you feel friendship when you're with your friends. You feel desire when you're with someone you desire, when you're engaged in that sort of relationship. And to take it completely out of context in this very individualistic way is really unnatural and strange and misleading.
Right. And if we take the way that the film describes this framing that's happening within this industry, really men's sexual dysfunction is treated as a physiological dysfunction, quote unquote, having erectile something or other.
Erectile dysfunction, I believe, is something. What Viagra cures.
Right. So it's this thing they describe as, well, it goes up and it goes down. You can sort of see when it's not working. If it doesn't go up, it's not working. But if you want it to go up and it doesn't go up, I guess. Not to make light of that. But on the flip side, for women, the issue is really centered around this lack of desire for sex. So it's treated as, it seems, primarily a psychological,
or, I mean, it comes in various forms, right? There's the disinterest, lack of desire, but then there's also difficulty with orgasm.
Right.
And there's one woman in the film who's interviewed, and she's a client of some of the clinicians we meet in the film, and she feels really bad and diseased. She's got a disorder. She feels terrible because she's not normal. And she's not only willing to go through clinical trials for trying drugs, but she also experiments with the orgasmatron, which is an electrical implant in the spine that's supposed to make it possible to have an orgasm by pressing a button that's hooked up to this device in her spine, although it doesn't really work, so it just makes her left leg shake a lot. It's actually pretty funny. But as it turns out, what she is defining as dysfunction and as disorder and disease is that she has orgasms, as it turns out. She just doesn't have them during intercourse.
Yes.
And she's astonished to learn that, in fact, most women do not have orgasms during intercourse. And by the end of the film, she finds this out. She gets this new knowledge, and she's like, oh, well, you've just changed the whole picture for me.
Yeah,
never mind this disease stuff.
Yeah, she's cured.
Cured.
With knowledge.
Yes.
Yeah, and information. And actually, we see her at points, and this film was made over the course of 6 years. So we see her evolution and her struggle. This is, I mean, you know, the film uses humor in some very effective ways, and there's some animation and different methods for achieving that. But there are also some real tough moments, and the realization is that there's an industry creating a panic and a need for something that is ultimately really going to be profitable for the pharmaceutical companies, and to continue to hold women captive to a disorder or a dysfunction that could better be cured in many, many other ways.
Yeah.
And the scientists never quite recognize, if at all, that there is something, as you said, to the relationship part of this. And even some articles of recent speculating that maybe it's monogamy that's really the problem, or that it's, you know, it's depression that's the problem, or it's this or it's that, or whatever it is, you know.
Or it's as in the case of the woman in the film, it's defining what's normal in a very strange inadequate way. But we see a lot of things that as it turns out, when they do the study that Kanner is initially hired for, they find out that the pornography works. The drug doesn't seem to help any more than the porn does, but porn works for sure. We also, we meet Carol Queen, who at the Vibrator Museum, and of course, vibrators work, toys work, better relationships work. There's another woman we see who talks about having been in her previous relationship and she never wanted to have sex because she was working all the time and she had two kids and she had a partner who never helped with the housework and she was doing it all and she was just exhausted. And now, you know, she's in a much better relationship and her partner helps with the housework more. And so, like, sex is fine now, you know. And so that somebody like that should not be encouraged to define the problem as her own failing or disorder or disease or shortcoming in some way. It's clearly context. We also see some people talking about their experiences with sexual violence and trauma, talking about problems with body image and feeling like, oh, I'm too fat to be having sex. I should be like holding in my stomach while I'm, which is clearly not the sort of frame of mind that is going to bring you to sexual bliss.
Right. Yes.
So we do get a sense in the film of all of the many kind of contextual issues that the pharmaceutical companies would like to just bypass and convince women that the problem is themselves, and here's a pill you can take and that will fix it. And we don't have to change anything else in the society. We don't need to increase women's sexual pleasure by, you know, ending sexism. That might be a help.
Oh, yeah. As if. We need a pill for that.
Yeah. If we can find the cure to patriarchy, that would be really a service to the planet, I think.
Totally. Well, Fran, this is been myself, Denise Morris, and Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour, reviewing the documentary film by Liz Kanner, Orgasm, Inc.
Available at the Multnomah County Public Library.
You never go to nightclubs and you just don't care to dance. You don't have time for silly things like moonlight and romance. You only think of dollar bills tied neatly in a stack. But when you kiss a dollar bill, it doesn't kiss you back. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink.
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. That was Keeley Smith and Louis Prima singing a curious song from the late 40s called Enjoy Yourself. That particular verse has always caught my ear for the way that at the cusp of the post-war boom and a resurgent consumerist economy, it mocks miserliness in favor of enjoyment. And before that, we heard our movie moles reviewing Orgasm, Inc., a documentary about turning a profit off of female sexual enjoyment and anxiety. Well, I'm joined with Peter Frace. Peter Frace is a editor of Jacobin magazine. He is also a PhD student in sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center out in New York. He has recently written a piece for In These Times, which he has written for before as well, called Redefining Work, which we are going to talk about today. Thanks for joining us again.
Good to be back, Joe.
So you start off citing a Congressional Budget Office report that has often been described since it came out as projecting job losses as a result of the Affordable Care Act. What's interesting about that for you and how we might respond to it?
Well, this was a bit that was buried in a long Congressional Budget Office report on the economic impact of the Affordable Care Act. And it was initially a lot of times reported sort of the way you just said it, as Affordable Care Act is going to lead to a loss of jobs. But that's not quite right. Because what it actually said was that a significant number of people, because they were able to obtain affordable health insurance that was not linked to employment, would choose not to seek work. This could be people that wanted to go into early retirement, possibly people that had serious health conditions. Could also be people who wanted to go to school and not have to work at the same time. So it was not as though the jobs were being destroyed, although that was, of course, how the right wanted to portray it. It was simply that labor supply was going to fall because of this sort of side effect of changing the market for health insurance.
What do you think is the significance of whether it is made to appear as like this social harm versus, you know, people just kind of reorganizing the way they spend their lives?
Well, so a lot of the conversation, what you saw a lot from the right, but also from some liberals, is this notion that this is a bad thing, even if it's people voluntarily choosing to drop out of the labor force, because there's something inherently good about people having jobs, which then gets to this question of, well, why was that the case? Why do we think that's the case? Is there really something besides the fact that people need money to live that makes it desirable to push as many people as possible into performing wage labor?
One of the things that your arguments about work seem to hinge upon is the recognition that we mean or tend to mean many different things when we talk about work. What kind of distinctions are you making and why are they important?
Where I always sort of start with this stuff particularly is to think about what work means specifically in a capitalist society versus what it might mean in some other type of society, what it meant in pre-capitalist social formations, what it might after capitalism. So, you know, the capitalist society is distinguished by the fact that most people are one way or another dependent on working for wages for survival. And so that's work in its very narrow, very specifically capitalist sense. But that can be separated from this idea of there is activity that, you know, needs to be performed for the reproduction of the society that we live in. That's often not paid, right? There's still much of the work of the care work of raising children or caring for elders is work that's necessary, but that's often not performed for wages. And then there's also this idea of sort of activity as self-actualization, of taking, you know, planning out and disciplining yourself to achieve a task. And that might be something that you get satisfaction from doing at paid work. Often it might not be. But that, again, is a sort of a separate level of what work is. And I think what's so pernicious about the rhetoric of work as it comes from both Democratic and Republican politicians is it makes it sound like these are all the same things, that we should all somehow be able to both contribute to society and make a living and feel personally fulfilled by what we're doing all at the same time, when I think for probably most people, that's the exception more than it is the rule.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking with Peter Frace about challenging dominant ways of talking about and valorizing work. Now, part of what you're doing in this article, it seems, is responding to challenges brought to the kind of perspective on work and the necessity of being able to exit work that you're arguing for. They pit commitment and discipline against a radical right to exit that you argue for. How do you make sense of this tension?
I think you're talking about the idea that there are all kinds of things that go far beyond wage work that do require, as you said, commitment, require you being willing to engage in a common project with other people in a way that has to be sustained over time. And then those things are hard to negotiate. I mean, it is hard to hold together projects like that. The advantage of the system of wage labor is that since people are dependent on it, it's easier to keep people engaged in their tasks. And it's true that if you want to do anything from, making community radio or, you know, writing software or whatever it is that you might try to do on a voluntary basis, it's harder to do it when you're doing it as a negotiation between truly free people, or rather than, you know, employing people who are essentially dependent and subordinated because of the reliance on the wage. And that's just sort of the challenge of, you know, becoming a more truly free society, I think. And that's what I want to get at the core of the critique of wage labor, is that it's this fundamentally unfree aspect of what's supposed to be a free society that people sort of ignore, because the world of work is sort of out of view when we talk about politics and we talk about freedom.
Where could organized labor fit into this as a means of bringing that kind of world into being? Because organized labor, as radical union organizers will often point out, has been influenced and corrupted essentially by labor law, by legalistic and business frameworks that give them extra incentive to, you know, keep the work system in place. And yet organized labor has, for many people on the left, many people who want some sort of truly free society, as indispensable to bringing that about. How are we to kind of bring that back to organized labor as a demand, like the IWW used to demand for a 4-hour day?
Right. The way I sort of think about this is that this is part of a you know, a whole set of issues where the labor movement, particularly in the United States, has often gone in for kind of a narrow understanding of its own interests, that even from the standpoint of just trying to protect your members and protect their jobs and improve their wages and working conditions, it's short-sighted to think that these larger questions of dependence on the wage are not relevant. They're very relevant because the thing sort of backstops labor's bargaining power is precisely the right of exit that the worker has, the ability that they have, whether it means temporarily to go on strike or permanently to leave employment altogether. And the more flexibility people have to do that, the more it's also possible for labor to struggle within work, even while some of us are also struggling against work in the sense of wage labor. And I don't pretend that that's always an easy thing to sell these sort of conservative institutions with a lot of inertia. But on the other hand, I think everybody recognizes that organized labor is in crisis, and so there is a certain amount of openness to new ideas.
So you point out how the right to exit is important to kind of making labor struggle substantial again. And I think of how 100 years ago, socially necessary kind of needs and services, for lack of a better way of putting it, were pretty quickly met by the communities that existed back then. But over the course of the 20th century, as community in all kinds of ways, especially kind of close economic community, pre-capitalist economic community, as much as we might say it's still around, has been like totally degraded. And when we talk about the right to exit, it depends upon a certain assumption about how people are able to meet their needs. And I don't think those old kinds of communities will spontaneously emerge because people are not rooted in the same kinds of pre-capitalist resource distribution and production networks that they once were.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that I would say about that. I mean, it's absolutely true that, I mean, this is the story of development of capitalism and capitalist democracy over the last 100, 200 years, is that as these sort of older communities were worn down, people fought for the more kind of impersonal welfare state to make up for the fact that you couldn't count on having those kind of personal resources, family and community to fall back on. And I would also say we shouldn't be overly quick to lament passing of that kind of community. I don't think you want to romanticize it, because in a certain sense, when I talk about the right of exit, the right to exit from the community you grew up in is just as important as the right to exit your job in a certain sense, right? You know, communities can be parochial, they can be oppressive. And it was that sort of atomizing impulse of capitalism that gave people, for example, who were gay, the ability to run away to the city and find a new life where they might not have been accepted in their own community. And so finding ways to sort of facilitate that freedom while, you know, making it a real freedom and not sort of leaving people to starve if they can't find income in the market, that's the sort of needle we're trying to thread now, I think.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Peter Frace about an article he wrote for In These Times magazine about redefining work. We'll provide a link to that article when the audio for this conversation is posted online, where you'll also be able to hear me and Peter talk for several more minutes on redefining work and what it means to fight for a free society. Thanks for joining us again, Peter.
Thank you.
Conditions, they are bad, and some of you are sad. You cannot see your enemy, the class that lives in luxury. You working men are poor, will be forevermore, as long as you permit the few to guide your destiny. Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. Oh, this earth by right belongs to toilers, and not to spoilers of liberty. The master class is small, but they have lots of gall. When we unite to gain our right, if they resist, we'll use our might. There is no middle ground. This fight must be one round to victory for liberty. Our class is marching on. Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. Oh, this earth by right belongs to toilers and not to spoilers of liberty. Oh, working men unite, we must put up a fight. Make us free from slavery and capitalistic tyranny. This fight is not in vain. We've got a world to gain. Will you be a fool, a capitalist too? Let's serve your enemy. Shall we still be slaves and work for wages? It is outrageous, has been for ages. Oh, this earth by right belongs to toilers and not to spoilers of liberty.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. We just heard Joe Glazer's version of Working Men Unite, an old wobbly tune written by E.S. Nelson that shares a melody line with Woody Guthrie's own famous song, Union Made. Before that, I was talking with Peter Frace about redefining work, a conversation that we continue and that you can listen more into online. To finish today's show, Jan Hocken is now joined by Madeline Burroughs from Seattle talking about Mom, Baby, God, a stage performance that she'll be giving at Refuge PDX this Wednesday and Thursday, the 5th and 6th. Jan.
Welcome to KBOO, Madeline Burroughs.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, well, we're so delighted that you are including Portland in your national tour of Mom, Baby, God, a provocative title for sure, described as a tour de force, a brilliant undercover look into the anti-abortion movement. And let's talk about the ideas behind the piece. And I'd like to particularly focus on the role of humor in this movement. I think it's worth noting that perhaps the one thing pro-choice and pro-life activists agree on is that getting an abortion is not funny business. Mm-hmm. So what does your performance take up and use humor through this as a force in activism? Can you tell us about the concepts behind the film and how it works as a parody?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the interesting thing is that it's really not intended. Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're
okay,
coming through.
Sorry. I'm calling from the NARAL office, and they're getting a call in, so I just wanted to make sure. Yeah, the play. I really made an effort with it to not embellish what was happening within the right wing, and I did all this undercover research on the particularly youth anti-choice movement, and really tried to stay true to it. So it's interesting because I think with left-wing audiences, people find it hilarious, but it's not something that I'm playing up and embellishing and trying to intentionally just poke fun at them. I'm really trying to expose what's really happening. And I think some of the stuff about, you know, the sexual purity talks and purity rings and all of this stuff that's completely scientifically inaccurate that you hear in the show can be funny to a left-wing audience, but it's also simultaneously terrifying because it's very real. And I think another aspect of the show that audiences really connect with in the humor is it follows a central character who's a teenage girl named Jessica Beth Giffords, who has a video blog called I'm a Pro-Life Teen, which are real things on the internet. You can find them on YouTube. And she's just like any teenage girl. She has a huge crush on Justin Bieber. She, you know, is trying to figure out her sexuality, but she's also trying to be this mega leader in the pro-life movement. And so the play really follows the contradictions of that and kind of the explosion of what happens for anybody, for any girl in particular, when you try and achieve this completely impossible duality of being super sexy and hot for boys of America, but also being sexually pure and not having any sexuality at all.
So clearly the performance piece places abortion politics in the context of sexual anxieties in the right, as well as perhaps in the broader culture, that there is this, sounds like you're saying there is this kind of hyper-sexualized aspects of girl culture that conservative young women are caught up in, but also the renunciatory side that the anti-abortionists have kind of captured with moralizing the issue.
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the things that I really learned from going undercover into the movement was I think that the anti-abortion movement is really trying to seize on a lot of feminist rhetoric. And one of the things that they're capitalizing on is the reality that for girls and women who've grown up in the past, you know, 40 years since Roe v. Wade, things have gotten even more challenging in a lot of ways, not because of the advances, of course, but because of the backlash and because there's been a hypersexualization of girls and women, and there's not necessarily a healthy way for us to experience our sexuality in a society that, you know, sexualizes girls as young as 5 years old. Then what that movement does is say, look, this is the fault of abortion and contraception. They've created this hypersexual, exploitive culture, when I think, of course, we want to say that's actually not the case. You know, we don't actually have a healthy culture for girls and women to experience their sexuality, and a big part of that is the sexually repressive, forced purity kind of thing that the movement is really all about.
Of course, that was an important distinction between first wave and second wave feminism, was the role in general in the movement of sexual liberation politics. And this was also an important issue in the late 19th century and early 20th century. Some feminists and suffragists feeling that if birth control was freely available to women, that it would promote sexual irresponsibility among men.
Right.
And so there's always been this, I think part of what I find interesting about this piece is how it does draw out, I haven't seen it yet, I'm very much looking forward to seeing it this week, but how it seems to draw out the complexity of sexual politics and ambivalence among young women about the whole concept of choice, what it means to choose.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the voices that you hear in the show is somebody who's from an organization called New Wave Feminists for Life. And she kind of embodies, I think, exactly what we're talking about, of this strain within conservative feminism that's always existed, I think, historically, where her central argument is that abortion has actually made it easier for men to just sleep with women with no consequences and to not take responsibility for their actions. And I think, you know, one of the things I really identified with some of these women when I was interviewing them was just the tragedy of and a shared experience that so many women have of feeling used and exploited, and of course the direction that they were taking with the conclusions of that of their activism were completely different from mine. I would say that was actually the most challenging part of the research and the conversations I was having, was not being able to just convince some of these people who I felt like were drawing on the same frustrations of how hard it is to be a woman in the 21st century, but then were drawing these completely conservative conclusions that were actually very, very repressive against women's rights and bodies.
I think that's an important point you make. I mean, there are a couple points. One involves the way in which conservative movements and progressive ones tap into real anxieties in people that are important to address, as well as then how they frame those anxieties in conservative or progressive ways. But you're saying that the right to life or anti-abortion movement has really tapped into something real that we need to address and not just shout them down. And then the other issue I'd like to have you speak to that I think you alluded to earlier involves the ethics, kind of feminist ethics in going into doing underground research. We had an interesting review earlier on the show today of a documentary film called Orgasm Inc. involving, mm-hmm. based on a feminist project going underground, doing underground research on the medicalizing of female sexuality. But you also carried out research kept your own agenda close to the vest, obviously. And yet it sounds like you've tried not to produce a caricature of the other side, although isn't some of that inevitable in parody? And perhaps that is important. How do you draw that line, mm-hmm. between a caricature, yeah. which is kind of a cheap shot at the other side, versus a kind of transgression of shame where you kind of use parody to kind of throw the experience of shame back onto the other side or shift the moral terrain in some
mm-hmm.
way?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that was a really tough thing for me when I was creating the show. I really struggled at first with what kind of direction I wanted to take it with. At first, I wanted to do a piece that was much more kind of documentary theater style that included both anti-abortion voices and pro-choice activists. So I actually interviewed a number of pro-choice activists and had incredible discussions with folks who've been doing this, doing reproductive rights work for decades. And I decided ultimately to only focus on the right wing, in part because I felt like if left-wing audiences came to the show and saw somebody that they identified with on stage very clearly, that they would just see these right-wing voices as completely a caricature and also not that scary and wouldn't take them that seriously. And I really wanted to completely immerse people within the movement so they could start to see, okay, I'm understanding now how these people are thinking, and now I understand why they're actually gaining so much ground, and now I want to figure out how the heck I'm going to respond to this. So it was always my intention to be really honest about all of the tactics in the movement, and they gave me tons of material. I mean, I don't want to give away too much about the show, but there's tons of stuff that you'll see in the show that you'll think I completely made up, and it's really, I didn't have to, because they are using every tactic in the book, including really interesting tactics to try and get young people involved, and a lot of drawing on pop culture, which is very interesting. As far as the ethics of going undercover and my intentions with that, I actually never had a fake identity. I never claimed to be a young pro-life activist or had a fake name or anything. And all I said was that I was a student, which I was at the time. I was a college student writing a thesis on youth pro-life activism, and almost every person I talked to was psyched about that. They were like, awesome, we need more academic work on the pro-life movement. This is fantastic. We want to support this and be involved. And some people even explicitly said, I don't even care what your politics are. I hope that, you know, this piece engages more people in what we're doing. So I actually think there are some right-wingers who, you know, might think that despite the intentions of the show, it could convert people to their movement, which I don't actually think is true. But, you know, I think they could look at it that way because of just how much it immerses people within it.
Yeah, I think that these distinctions you're making are very important, and I'm sure generate considerable discussion among other issues after the performances. Tell us a bit before you let our audience know how to buy tickets for this week, March 5th and 6th. But first, can you say a bit about audience responses? Of course, part of what's so important about political theater is the participatory side, the discussion afterwards, the sense in which it's a lived moment that never repeats itself. What has the audience response been like so far? Can you just say a bit about that?
Yeah, it's been really amazing. One thing to say about the audiences and just the demographics of people who've come out to the show is that for many actors, we have the experience of going up on stage and looking out and seeing a sea of gray hair. And that's not a knock against people with gray hair or people who are older, but I think that younger audiences in particular have been really cut off from theater culture, and because of the attack on arts funding, there has been less and less access and ability to see a piece of theater. Most people never see a piece of theater in the United States. So one thing is, it's been really exciting to perform for audiences who've never been in a theater before.
And can you tell us how to buy tickets? And I'm sure many of our listeners on the Old Mall would love to be part of those audiences and discussions,
yeah,
of
absolutely.
Range of demographics.
Yes.
Where do you buy tickets? I understand you have to pay cash if you buy at the door.
Right.
Tell us how to find the information and where you'll be performing.
You can buy tickets at mombabygod.com/schedule. And the shows are Wednesday and Thursday, March 5th and 6th at 8 p.m. It's $15 pre-sale, which you can buy online, and then $18 in cash at the door.
And what's the venue?
Oh, it's at Refuge PDX in Portland.
Great. And once again, I'd encourage people to check out the website, which is also very smart, and very much look forward to seeing your work this week. Thanks so much for being on the show today, and carry on the good work.
Thank you so much, Jan. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, this is Jan Hawken talking with Madeline Burroughs, writer of Mom, Baby, and God, who also performs in the play. Thanks so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host, Joe Clement. Thank you to Bill Resnick and Mark Weisbrot, to Denise Morris and Fran Michelle, to Jan Hawken and Madeline Burroughs, and to Peter Frace. You can find us online in a day or two. This show will be podcasted with all the links to anything that we mentioned, where there might be a link at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Tune in next week to hear Jan come back on with Mike Snedeker, our Leptin Law duo. They'll be talking about a Texas law, a new progressive Texas law that allows innocent people to get their convictions overturned. And up next is Air Cascadia.
And good morning. It is 10 a.m. and you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming up next is Chris Andre with Air Cascadia, and that is followed today by Locus Focus when host Barbara Bernstein speaks with David Hassmeyer of Inside Climate News about their investigation, which revealed the health and safety concerns from fracking the Eagle Ford shale play in Texas. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with science writer Judy Foreman about her book, A Nation in Pain. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, host Will Hall speaks with suicide attempt survivor David Webb, author of Thinking About Suicide, Contemplating and Comprehending the Urge to Die, about suicidal feelings and how talking openly about them is the best form of suicide prevention. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a KBOO member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on the Donate Now jar.
Now is the time to act the fool tonight. Forget about your worries and you will be all right.
KBOO Community Radio and Oaks Park Roller Rink proudly present Bounce, Roll, Skate. Tuesday, March 11th from 7 to 9 p.m. This is a family-friendly event for all ages. We'll be broadcasting a two-hour funk and disco mashup special live on 90.7 FM KBOO, and you can be a part of it. Feel free to dress up in your favorite 70s outfits, wigs, and costumes. That's Bounce, Roll, Skate, March 11th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Oaks Park Roller Rink. Call 503-231-8032 for more details, or go to kboo.fm/bounce-roll-skate.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, March 3rd, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community station at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We've got a few headlines coming up first on a rainy Monday morning, powering up towards that date, March 8th, when we're going to be in the streets telling corporate interests out of state and in many cases out of mind that we're not having coal and oil. No, not in Cascadia. But first, a few headlines. We're going to get started with news from around the world because in this case, we really are talking about World War III here. Look at the situation. Look at sub-Saharan Africa. We've totally forgot what's going on in the Congo there. Look at North Africa. Look at the Middle East. And now the almost certain prospect of war looms in where else? It's always the Balkans, isn't it? It's always that part of the world. Well, in any case, this week, today, in fact, in New York, and prepping for the big day tomorrow, when Benjamin Netanyahu comes to town. Netanyahu will be speaking, of course, at the annual policy conference of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, on Tuesday, tomorrow. He will, of course, be joined by a phalanx of, and by the way, phalanx is not a dirty word, of, except in this case, I suppose, of Washington power brokers, from John Kerry to John McCain. One European ambassador in D.C. said other U.S. allies, other countries could only dream of, for whatever reasons one would like to consider, Israel seems to have occupy a very special place in the heart of the American banking system. And, of course, not too close friendship with Barack Obama. That will be on the table today. The two men will be meeting